This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn with me, Dashran Johan. In conjunction with Merdeka, which is happening tomorrow, I'm joined by three young activists in different fields, namely youth advocacy, education, and women's rights, to discuss how far we've come as a nation since independence and what they hope to see in the future. So my guests on today's show are Kira Yusri. She's the co-founder of Undi 18, Hannah Jambunathan, who's a women's rights activist, as well as Kularatnam Vijay Kumar, who is a Teach for Malaysia alumni, as well as he's currently attached to the Yayasan Tunku Abdul Rahman. Welcome to the show, guys. How are y'all doing? And happy Merdeka.
Thanks for having us, Dashran.
Doing well today, Dashran.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, fantastic. Now, let's get right into it, right? It's been 64 years since we attained independence. How far have we come as a nation? Let's start with politics, Kira. When you look at where we are politically today, and Malaysian democracy as a whole, do you think we have progressed or regressed over the years?
I think I'm on the perspective that it's always a work in progress, right? I think back then we have different issues, different problems. Today we have different issues that we're facing. But one thing I think is quite clear is that, culture of corruption is still prevalent, and it's one of the things that remains holding us back in being a progressive nation, in my opinion, right? If you look at institutional reforms, I think we still have a very colonial law that was around to suppress political dissent even before Merdeka, such as the Sedition Act, which was back then was used to suppress communists, but today is still being used to suppress activists as young as 20 years old, like Sarah Irdina. So I think on that aspect, freedom-wise, quote-unquote, I don't think we have improved much, especially if you see in recent times. But I still remain hopeful because it means that more and more people are speaking up, more and more people are highlighting injustices, especially those done by the state. And then I think if you look toward the future, I think we should always remain hopeful, because without that, I think it's going to be very challenging to progress.
Now, Kira, there was a time where, students or youth used to lead massive movements against right-wing administrations, even leading movements against the British themselves. However, in his first tenure as Prime Minister, Tun Dr. Mahathir, very infamously worked towards silencing the voices of the youth by implementing things like AUKU, right? Which essentially, banned university students from participating actively in politics, from getting involved in political movements and things like that. But today, are the youths today starting to wake up and fight back again?
Yeah, well, when Pakatan Harapan took over in government, one of their manifesto was to abolish AUKU. And as we all know, AUKU itself has set back student activism for about 20-something years, right? Students were not allowed to utilize speakers' corners. Student elections were hugely controlled by university administration. Political parties were not allowed to interfere at all. All students would risk, and some of them have been suspended or expelled from university with their scholarships taken away. I think, and from what I understand, during PH time, there was a plan to abolish it entirely, but they begin by amending it slightly first. So if I'm not mistaken, now political parties are allowed to penetrate universities. That's why you have groups like Mahasiswa UMNO, Mahasiswa DAP, Mahasiswa Keadilan Malaysia, which is it's a mirror of PKR and so on and so forth. So I think it has, when Tun Mahathir became Prime Minister the second time, so there have been some improvements. But I think what's more interesting is that organically, students are organizing inter-university, right? So student activism is not just limited to their own universities anymore, thanks to social media. You have groups like Y Politics, you have groups like Loud Asians Maya Movement, and to some extent, even the Undi 18 movement have seen organic collaboration of university students, because with social media, with digital tools, they can now become collectives and they can now become organic groups that doesn't need permission from institutions anymore. So I think in that aspect, student and youth activism is growing because they are reacting to the current situations. And I think, you know, with more and more instability comes around, more and more people want to you know, come out and challenge the norm or at least make a difference. So I think you'll see a lot more of these groups either making an impact. You know, an example, a great example is Miss Solidarity, right? Mm. They went from online activism, from creating infographics to offline mobilization and offline impact. So much so to the point that the state was so threatened by them. So I think the growth of these groups are very healthy, and I really welcome seeing their journey and the impact that they'll make over the next 20, 30 years.
Hannah, what about women's rights? From independence to right now, where are we at exactly? How far have we progressed? Have we even progressed to begin with?
So I think with women's rights, there are arguments to be made for both progression and regression. Mm-hmm. And I think there's no definite or decisive answer that we can give to this, but we can say that we've had some really high moments and some really low moments. Some of the highs that we've had have been, you know, recognizing domestic violence as a crime, the enactment of the DVA in 1994, the fact that Malaysia ratified to CEDAW, you know, saying on that international platform that we have an obligation to uphold women's rights. And I think on the whole as well, echoing a little bit what Kira said just now as well, efforts and awareness to defend the rights of women and girls and strive forward towards gender equality have steadily gained traction since independence. I think now, especially with social media, we're on a whole new level of advocacy about women's rights. But the lows are really prominent as well. Even in the last year, we've seen such huge, significant spikes in domestic violence, especially during the first MCO. WA's inquiries actually increased fourfold over the last year, which is really a terrifying statistic to be confronted with. Mm-hmm. And every day, there's something new too. There's some new harmful rhetoric that's being endorsed or espoused by people in power here in Malaysia, which is really still very worrying. And this accompanied by the significant gaps that we are seeing in our legal frameworks and the gaps that we are seeing in our political representation. I think what is really definite about women's rights in Malaysia, 64 years on from independence, is that we've still got a really long, long way to go about it.
Yeah. And I think that's something I want to press further, right? Because sometimes when we talk about women's rights, you always have these, I'm just going to call them troll comments, right? People who say, oh, but what exactly is the problem here in Malaysia? If you look, you know, women have the right to education here. That's not an issue. Women can vote in Malaysia. That's not an issue. Women can go to work in Malaysia. That's not an issue. So people, you know, keep bringing these things up. But at the same time, when we look at other issues, like some of, you know, you've brought up the gaps that the pandemic has highlighted, which we will get into a little bit later. And also this idea of, you know, just speaking up. For example, when we look at Ain Husnisa, who went on TikTok and she basically talked about her teacher who made a very inappropriate remark about rape and then calling it a rape joke in class. And now she's getting sued, you know, by the teacher for a million ringgit, and which is ridiculous, right, when we think about that. But yet there doesn't seem to be, you know, enough legal framework. And more than that, even the cultural understanding among people, when we look at the comments that have been, you know, thrown towards her, that she deserves what's coming, that she's, you know, made the teacher's life miserable. What does that tell you about how far, you know, how much more we have to go?
It tells me, it paints a really terrible picture, what you've just painted. Yeah, I agree. I agree. It's what Ayn has gone through and has been really terrible. It's been really terrible to see the lack of legal and structural support that she's received, just essentially nothing. And it's also really been awful to see how people have reacted to her and called her names. And I think she even got a rape threat from one of her schoolmates, mm-hmm. which really just shows you how insidious this kind of culture, rape culture, is in our society. It's that children in school, children, are threatening to rape each other. I think on the positive side of things, the amount of positive support that Ayn has received is also worthy to mention and also really notable, as like just an indicator of how far we have come and how many mindsets are changing or have changed.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important for Ayn, a little plug here maybe, that our government steps up and thinks about how to make the legal framework better, how to put in a sexual harassment bill and enact a gender equality act to really send a clear message that sexual harassment or any form of gender-based violence is not going to fly in this country. It needs to send a clear message to survivors that they can come forward and they'll be protected, and it sends a clear message to harassers as well that there will be recourse and there's absolutely no excuse for abuse.
Certainly. Now, Kula, let's talk about our education system, right? Many will argue that our education system, particularly our public education system, has declined over the years, which is why most parents these days who can afford it prefer to put their children in private schools and universities. What is your take on this? Would you agree with this?
So this is a bit of a complicated question. I know most of the people I speak to, if I ask them about Malaysian education, their immediate response is that it's much worse.
Right.
But I would say that it's honestly quite hard to tell. It really depends on what metrics you use. And I would say that one thing that relates to more Malaysians who can afford it going to private and international schools is that private and international schooling has really boomed in Malaysia over the last 20 to 30 years. The people of 30 years ago did not have the same options as the youth of today. And because of that, I would say you see more people electing for these choices. However, if you were to ask me how Malaysian education is as a whole, from independence all the way up to now, I would say in terms of access, it has improved tremendously. Not going to lie, education in Malaysia was never going to be an easy thing. You know, you have multiple disparate communities, you have multiple different contexts, you have a massive urban-rural divide. And with all of that in mind, I would say our achievements are pretty meaningful. That doesn't cover up for our mistakes, of course, but to give you some context. For example, in 1967, only 1% of Malaysians received a university education. And of that 1%, it was 3 men for every 1 woman. And if you look at it now, up to 18% of Malaysians go to university now. And the average university student now is a woman. 61% of university students are women now. And that is definitely an achievement. However, it does not cover for significant missteps in other areas. For example, as was shared by Hannah and yourself about the case of Ayn, where there have not really been any significant statements on the case on behalf of the ministry, nor has there been any concrete action beyond transferring the teacher that was involved, which, to my knowledge, is the typical course of action in these cases. You know, teachers are not really disciplined as much as they are transferred between different departments or states. And it's definitely unfortunate.
Right. Now, you mentioned that there are areas where things have improved, right? And there's a massive improvement, in fact, when you talk about access to education. But what about when it boils down to the quality of the education? You say it depends on which metrics you use. How do you look at our quality, the quality of education in Malaysia over the years? Because I think when we talk to people on the outside, it is like you said, everyone is just like, oh, our education is terrible. Let's put our kids in private schools. Or, you know, people just bring up things like, oh, our university rankings, or it used to be, you know, one of the best in Asia at one point. Let's say University of Malaya, for example. And then now perhaps it has dropped down the rankings. So people just bring up things like this. So when it comes to quality of education, do you think we have improved, regressed, or has it just been pretty much where it needs to be?
So there are two elements to this. And I think, let me talk about the perception element, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say there is this perception that the quality of education in Malaysia has reduced simply because education in Malaysia has become a lot more politicized. In fact, every prime minister of Malaysia, with the exception of Ismail Sabri, was previously the minister, and well, Tunku Abdul Rahman was previously the minister of education.
Right.
And because of that, I think, you know, to further their political careers, there were a lot of big policy swings that may not have been properly analyzed. So over the past, you know, 10 to 20 years, we saw a lot of back and forth about whether to use English as a medium for instruction or not. And ultimately, the people that suffer as a result of, you know, these political moves are teachers and students. So I think a lot of the criticism that comes with regards to our educational quality relates to the amount of policy changes that come about as a result of political moves. Mm. However, that said, when it comes to university rankings, me personally, I have a bit of an issue with university rankings, because university rankings, they look at certain other factors that I would argue are not 100% relevant to the quality of education a student receives. So for example, one of the metrics used to determine a university's ranking is the amount of international students that the university receives. And another metric as well is how much research that university produces. And I do acknowledge both of these things are a valuable part of the student experience. But is someone's education worse just because they come from a university that doesn't produce much research and doesn't have many international students?
Mm.
I don't feel so. I myself went to a university that is not even in the top 500, I believe, and I felt that I received a good enough education. So I feel like there is a lot of metrics for comparison, but I'm not confident enough to say that it is a reason to say that education has gotten worse. Generally, when we speak to people about this, they complain about policy issues. For example, the introduction of moral education or how learning is done in Malay rather than English now.
Right. On the show with me today is Kira Yusri. She's the co-founder of Undi 18, Hannah Jambunathan, women's rights activist, as well as Kularatnam Vijayakumar. He's a Teach for Malaysia alumni and is currently attached to Yayasan Tunku Abdul Rahman. After the break, I'll be asking them what their version of an ideal Malaysia would look like. We'll be back with more on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Kira Yusri. She's the co-founder of Undi 18, Hannah Jambunathan, who's a women's rights activist, and Kularatnam Vijayakumar, who is a Teach for Malaysia alumni and is currently attached to Yayasan Tunku Abdul Rahman. And in conjunction with Merdeka, we're discussing how far Malaysia has come since independence and what the country should look like ideally down the road. Okay, so now let's switch gears to the pandemic. So now I think many of the issues faced by our country have been present for years. But it was tend to be ignored or swept under the rug. However, it seems like, you know, the pandemic has pretty much exposed the massive gaps in our nation, right? So Hannah, when it comes to women's rights and equality, what are some of the gaps highlighted by the pandemic that you think needs addressing immediately?
Where do I start with what the pandemic has laid bare for all of us to see? I think something that's very pressing, again, I had just mentioned this a little while ago, but the for WAO alone, the amount of inquiries and calls we received about domestic violence have hit some really high highs. 2020, there was a 72% increase in calls over the course of that first initial MCO. And in 2021, though there's been a small decrease from 2020, we're still about fielding about double the number of inquiries pre-COVID. And what's being done? What's being done to show survivors of domestic violence that they're supported and protected? There's a really dangerous shadow pandemic that's been happening for over now 1.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that's gender-based violence and discrimination. The pandemic has exposed all of this, but the response to it and the government response to it, coupled with the political maneuvering that we've seen so much of in these last few years, has caused not only a spike in GBV, but it's also disrupted response systems as we had established them. And yeah, besides that, we've seen just so many, besides domestic violence, we've seen so many other instances of gender-based violence. coming to the front during the pandemic, you know. Mm-hmm. There have been numerous accounts of sexual harassment at roadblocks by authority figures. There was, again, another horrific story of a rape of a girl child in remand. I think what we all should understand, and maybe this is not something that we widely think about, is that in crisis settings, like we're experiencing right now, women and girls already face considerable barriers to accessing resources and just being at risk. And these are all further exacerbated by the pandemic. So the pandemic really reinforced all these inequalities. You know, period poverty or menstrual hygiene care took access to menstrual hygiene right. care took a real big hit over COVID as well, and really hampered the ability of vulnerable communities, especially low-income households, refugee communities, to access these essential items that they need for their health. And the pandemic also really revealed how discrimination or inequality in the workforce is still very prevalent. And if I'm right, I think it's about 2.5% of the number of employed women fell during the pandemic, while the number of employed men only fell by 0.5%.
Right.
So these numbers all help us just visualize a little bit how women in Malaysia have been hit the hardest by this pandemic.
Certainly. Now, you know, Kula, when it comes to education, right, the pandemic has also sort of highlighted a lot of serious issues. Now, on the one end, when we look at people in our circles, right, our immediate circles, our nieces and all of that, most people, the complaints that we have heard over the past 1.5 years is that, you know, online classes aren't very good. It doesn't, you know, encapsulate the full teaching and learning experience, that students can't mm-hmm. focus. You know, kids are just turning off their camera and then playing games and doing things like that. Nobody knows what they're doing. But on the mm-hmm. other end, there are students who have to climb trees just to get internet access in the first place, you know, to take an exam or to do their homework. This is just one issue, I think, that the pandemic has highlighted, right? What are your thoughts on this? What are some of the other issues that the pandemic has really highlighted when it comes to gaps in our education system, and what needs to be done immediately?
So I think to answer your question, let me just take a step back to what Hannah said earlier. I think the biggest issue that the pandemic has exposed with regards to our education system is actually the lack of welfare provided for students who are in need. So, for example, when it comes to gender-based violence, where it involves children or, like, you know, domestic abuse, it is often teachers who are the ones to find out and report these things. But teachers rarely get the training that's required on how to handle these cases. So if a student comes to you and shares this with you, you know, you're unsure what to do about it because it's not something you were trained for. But speaking more specifically about the gaps caused by the pandemic itself, I would say the biggest gap is exposed is really the lack of training provided to teachers when it came to online learning,
right?
And the lack of professional development. And I say that because there is a culture of fear in schools almost. And what we noticed is that during the pandemic, in spite of students facing all of these additional stresses, for example, some of the students we worked with immediately started working in order to support their families because their parents became unemployed. And at the same time, they were receiving more homework than normal from school, from their teachers. And the reason for that is because on the side of the teachers, there is this requirement to show that you're doing work. It doesn't matter if this work is necessarily beneficial for the student or not, but for the sake of documentation, you need to prove that you're doing work and to prove that you're teaching. And one of the ways to do that is to give out homework. So a lot of times, if students, you know, disengage from the schooling process during online learning, I don't blame them at all because it is an extraordinary stressful time. You know, adults talk about it all the time. You know, it's so difficult to exist during the pandemic. But for some reason, the same consideration is not extended to our students.
Right.
Yeah. And beyond that, I would say the other large problem, really, the first one, of course, is centralization in the education system, where the education ministry gets to decide en bloc for the whole of Malaysia when schools open and close, when that decision-making should be made at the district level. And beyond that, it's just good policy, but poor execution. You know, when it comes to internet access, the Malaysian Ministry of Education has been discussing providing free internet access since 2011. You know, we've had plans for this, for providing free Wi-Fi in every school since 10, 15 years ago. But if you look now, it's still not the case.
Right. So do you think, with that in mind, that one of the most important things that, you know, we could do moving forward is perhaps, you know, decentralize our entire education system so that, you know, communities where individual school principals, teachers and all have more autonomy to make decisions, even decisions on whether the school should be open or closed, you know, because there are some perhaps outskirts, rural area where there's no COVID cases at all, but yet the schools have to be closed because of the one size fits all solutions and things like that. So do you think, you know, decentralizing is a important step that the country needs to take?
Oh, for sure. Definitely. And to be honest, if I could turn back the clock to March 2020, and if I was the minister, I would have just shut down. I would have just cancelled SPM for the year. I mean, they did that in the UK. They cancelled a set of A-levels examinations and they found an alternative. And there was no reason why we could not have done the same.
Okay. Now, Kira, I've got a slightly different question for you, right? Because when we talk about youth political engagement, we recently saw that an entire protest was essentially organized and mobilized through social media platforms. And the protest, you know, actually happened during a pandemic. There was social distancing and all of the measures, necessary measures taken. You guys have at Undi 18 have also, you know, run Parliament Digital, and now you have Day One Muda Malaysia. All of this were run or are currently being run completely virtually. What do you think is the significance of all of this?
I think it shows a shift in mobilization strategies, you know, and I think even though we have improved somewhat in terms of media freedom, for young people to access mass media to get their word out there is still something that's very, very challenging, you know. And I think even Undi 18 is still struggling in the aspect to a certain extent, right? Like we have some sympathize media outlets who, like, you know, support us, and BFM is one of them. But if you want to penetrate to, for example, a different kind of demographic, a different kind of audience, it's extremely difficult, right? So I think social media sort of like democratizes how we can get access to information, access to knowledge. And one thing that the SSR has been consistent on is producing multilingual content as well, right? We've done things in Malay, in English, in Mandarin, and we were in the works of doing even more Tamil translations as well. We work with Uni Sabah, Uni Sarawak to put out content in Kadazan and Iban, just so we want to make sure that access to information is not gatekept by, you know, language, for example. So right. I think in that sense, it's quite interesting to see how, even in SSR itself, how we managed to mobilize for the protest itself. Because I think on our side, the numbers that we confirmed, the critical masses, we were estimated only 400 to 500, right? But our estimation of the people that turned out was almost 2,000, right? Almost four times more than what we predicted. And all of that was attributed to social media mobilization. For politicians to, you know, if they were paying attention, I think they need to understand that for young people, who is eventually going to be the biggest block of voters in the next elections, will rely on social media for their source of information. They will not necessarily be relying on news articles. And I see certain politicians try to pivot, right? They use they upload a drama on social media, they live stream their parliamentary speeches. So these are ways for them to utilize social media in their favor. But still, that's still a minority, and that's not many politicians still using that. And for that, I think it's their loss, right? Because they don't want to utilize it as much as they could. But there's also shortcomings, of course, when it comes to using purely social media, right? Mm-hmm. You're unable to penetrate to areas without digital access. You're unable to penetrate certain demographics that may not be on Twitter or Instagram or Telegram, you know, which is the main platform that SSR disseminates information from. But I think these are shortcomings that, you know, SSR and other youth activists just have to keep working towards. You know, we shouldn't let these kind of barriers slow us down, because otherwise, what happens is that everyone is afraid they're not doing enough, and then they don't do anything, and then nothing changes. Right. And that is the biggest danger that's happening, right? So when many people say that young people are becoming more apathetic, we're becoming more cynical, I think to a certain extent, they are becoming cynical, but not towards politics, towards politicians, which is why you see youth movements rising up on social media. Because when the school don't allow them to speak up, when universities suppress their voices, social media is where they can fully express themselves, right? And even then, some of us face intimidation by the state for doing so. But it has not stopped young people from speaking up. And I think that's the beauty of social media and how it really democratizes activism in this new age. I think back then with Bursay, all that, it's very fascinating, right? To see how they can disseminate information so wide to the point where you can mobilize 500,000 people on the streets. But today, we have to understand the context of a pandemic. Things work differently. There are different risks. There are different considerations taken into account. So, for example, for the protest, we did not encourage people above a certain age to run, right? We did not encourage people with young children to come. We did not encourage people who live with elderly to come down because we don't want to risk it, right? So that's why you can blend online and offline collective support. As you can see, during the protest of the day itself, when Dataran was not open, we just put on Telegram, said Dataran is closed off to us. Please tweet Buka Dataran. And I think Buka Dataran had like how many 100,000 tweets that day. And on Facebook and Instagram, people just demanding PDRM to open it. Of course, they didn't listen. But the point is, you know, you raise awareness and you can easily highlight injustices through social media. And I think that's you know, an area that we need to focus on and sort of like learn how do we mobilize it to push against especially conservative or harmful narratives.
So guys, with that in mind, let's talk about the future, right? We know, you know, I think Kira brought it up. Progress is something that we've got to constantly work on, right? It's the path to progress is winding, it's bumpy. We're not going to see things change overnight. So let's look at 20 years into the future, you know, perhaps then we can really see the fruits of all of your labors, you know, what it would, how it would have transformed the country, you know, in one way or another. So Kula, what do you hope our education landscape would look like then, ideally?
So I think quite a bit of it is actually just building on our strengths, honestly. So first of all, it would be increasing the amount of social studies that we do, which, I mean, it was started by Dr. Masley, I think, in 2019. And I just hope to see that extend where, you know, all students get to learn subjects like philosophy. Beyond that, it would be to embrace our role as an educational hub for the world. You know, Malaysian students can go all across the world. You know, we've seen students go to China, Taiwan, UK, US, Australia, so on and so forth. And I think that's really a strength. And we have students coming from all across the world, you know, to prepare themselves from all across Asia, really, to prepare themselves, you know, to go to other countries for universities. I think that's definitely a strength of Malaysia. Beyond that, there's two welfare-related things that I think we in Malaysia could really improve on. First of all, would be to really fully embrace, you know, the role of a school as a community center. And what that means is you provide, you know, things like free breakfast, food baskets, screening for learning disabilities, counseling, and we already do this to some extent. If you remember when you were in primary school, you know, the dentist would come to your school all the time. Yes. So it's just building on that, right? And truly making the school a community center where for whatever you need, you can find it there. And the last thing, and this is one that I found is really lacking that we really need to change, is to honor mostly just provide more second chances to students. And what I mean is, let's say you're a Malaysian student taking SPM and you do really badly in your SPM. If you want to retake SPM, you have to do that as a private candidate and you have to go on and take tuition or whatnot. I can't enroll to be a student again. Or if I do, it's not really popularized. Similarly, let's say if you and me, we wanted to learn a new skill, like if I wanted to learn plumbing, okay. It's not easy for me to sign up to a community college. or to look for part-time courses. So it's just seeing us, I think, leveraging on adult learning and providing more adult learning opportunities, especially for people who may not have done well in FPM or in any other form of education previously.
Hmm. Kula, I also want to get your thoughts on, you know, an issue that especially it's been debated for years, but you know, every now and then it becomes this hot topic again. And I'm talking about vernacular schools. Mm-hmm. Where do you stand on the issue of vernacular schools? And does vernacular schools have a place in your ideal Malaysia?
I've been thinking about this a lot, honestly, because, you know, my gut reaction is saying like, oh, ideally, you know, we should get rid of not just vernacular schools, but private schools, international schools, religious schools, every type of school that's not a public school should go away. And the reason for that is so that we have a unified education system. All of the funding goes into the same system. Everybody gets a similar experience. However, I think the cat's out of the bag. And when people complain about vernacular schools, I think really what they're complaining about, the root cause really that they're complaining about is about segregation in society. And maybe they complain about racism too. And I don't think the solution to that is to get rid of vernacular schools. I think that's really just a political talking point. Because if you look at the data that's released by MOE themselves, the amount of Chinese and Tamil schools, it's less than 30% of schools overall. If you look at the amount of students, I think only about 25% of Malaysian students in general go to vernacular schools, which is about accurate for the amount of minorities that you have in Malaysia. And I think we've tried a few ways to get around this, but what we should be solving for is how do we make Malaysian society less segregated? Because I went to a national school, and after I graduated, I still ended up in a segregated society. So there are many ways to do this. Architects of Diversity did an incredible thing, Camp Mujibah, where they invited, you know, representatives from Islamic schools, from Chinese schools, and they got them to integrate. And I think National Service, when it was still around, did that as well. And I think there are solutions to segregation that don't involve destroying vernacular schools.
Hannah, what do you hope our country looks like 20 years from now in terms of equality?
I feel like I've said this every time you ask me a question. I'm like, oh, where do I start? And it's the same vibe for this question as well. 20 years from now, I would ideally want to see a country where women and girls are just free from violence and discrimination. I want to see a country where women can walk down the street and not be catcalled, not be followed. I want to see a country where girls can go to school and not face harassment or really inappropriate predatory behavior. I want to see a country where girls can actually have a childhood and not have child marriage be a prospect. In relation to all of these things, what I'm really trying to say is I want to live in a country that has a robust legal framework, you know, that protects women and girls. I want to live in a country that has a strong investment in public health measures to be able to respond to violence against women. I want to see a country where women are actively involved in decision-making processes at all levels, most especially the policymaking levels. I want to see a country where leadership prioritizes the upholding of these rights of women, of children, of people with disabilities and other vulnerable groups. I want to see a country where the leadership is committed to the rakyat and committed to efforts that strive to end violence, discrimination, and any and all forms of inequality. I want to see a country where women and girls are valued, respected, and protected. In 20 years, I want to be living in a better country for women.
I think that is absolutely wonderful, the way you've phrased everything there. Just a follow-up to that, you know, do you think we will be able to, would you like to, in the next 20, 30 years, perhaps, you know, see a female prime minister?
You know, never say never. I personally would love to. I really hope that we will. We had a landmark election of our first ever female DPN in Dr. Wan Azizah. Unfortunately, subsequent governments have not carried that forward. I think it'll be monumental to have a woman PM. And I think this has so many positive outcomes, can have so many positive outcomes for society, not just in terms of social justice and inter-community relations, which are, of course, very important, but also in terms of economics and GDP growth, international politicking, even health, right? And there's so much research to back this up. So many women-led countries have handled coronavirus better. And I think what it comes down to is that in Malaysia especially, we're so, so diverse. The inclusion of women at this political decision-making level is so important to really represent the variety, the nuance of realities of women in the country. And when these voices are contributing to policymaking, it really contributes to more meaningful impact and more meaningful solutions that really address the needs of communities in a more holistic manner, which will build a better Malaysia. And I think it's really important for Malaysian women to be able to see faces that look like theirs in politics and really hear voices that are championing concerns that they share. I just don't see a way that this is a bad thing. I really hope that we see a woman PM in Malaysia's future.
Yeah, certainly. I think that is the hope for many of us progressives, right? Because it's like you said, you know, even when we look at, you know, COVID management, countries with women leaders have been handling it better because they always tend to, you know, put emphasis on education and welfare more than, you know, flexing guns like most patriarchal politics, flexing the size of their military and things like that, right? So, Kira, on, you know, when you think of a mature, vibrant, thriving democracy, what do you think of? What do you hope Malaysia looks like in the future, particularly when it comes to youth engagement?
I think a thriving democracy needs to have an environment where freedom of expression and freedom of speech is a genuine aspiration. You know, I think it's impossible for us to have a thriving democracy with certain with suppressive acts that still prevents people from expressing themselves. For example, hopefully in the next few years, maybe not 20 years, hopefully it's much earlier than that, because, you know, these are actually very harmful laws, yeah. Right? But I think, you know, it's very optimistic to hope for our culture to change, to embrace dissent, to embrace democracy, if we don't focus on reforming the laws that prevent them in the first place, right? So I think my aspiration is that hopefully, you know, laws such as the Sedition Act is abolished entirely. Laws such as Section 233A of the Communications and Multimedia Act, which can charge you for online postings that are deemed offensive or irritating, which is absolutely ridiculous, right? It's so right. Ridiculous. Like, who determines what is irritating or annoying? How can you go to jail for something that's annoying, for being annoying, right? I mean, if that's the case, then many of our MPs would be in jail right now. I think, you know, a personal friend of mine, Heidi Kwa, from Refuge Refugees, was recently charged under this particular law. And all she did was she posted the reality of the conditions of migrants in detention centers, right? And she was charged, a police report was made to her by a civil servant. And, you know, among civil society, the law has a nickname of Akta Sakit Hati. Because, you know, if you look at the law, it says like something like postings yang menjengkelkan and things like that. So I think this kind of laws will actually push Malaysia towards regression. You know, we will not be able to teach our kids, to be critical thinkers, to be brave, to ask questions. Especially if all these laws are looking into online postings, right? You know, young people will not be able to know the extent of of freedom if they're worried that anything they say can get them in trouble. So I think if you want to have a thriving democracy, if you want to educate young people about democratic values, it has to start with these legal reforms. And I think interestingly enough, lately the government lately politicians have been talking about institutional reforms. You know, suddenly they care a lot about it. So I think these are important topics, and I guess the people need to pressure the government to also proceed with institutional reforms and not just focus only on the economy, you know, because the reason why I know, for example, many other countries are thriving economically as well is because their people are able to thrive, right? You know, we cannot ignore one sector of a democracy in favor of the other. So I think this Merdeka, I think we need to reflect back and understanding You know, if we think Malaysia is not good enough, what is actually holding us back? Is it the people? Is it the politicians? And how do we use our collective, you know, for me, it's I think it's collective anger, lah, right? Or the collective desire to see better change. And how do we channel that productively towards pushing our lawmakers to actually look into our legislation and improve the conditions for freedom of expression in Malaysia so we can have better discourse on critical topics? Like, you know, both what Kula and Hannah have mentioned earlier.
I think that's very well said. On that note, guys, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks, Dasha.
Thanks,
Dasha.
I've been speaking to Kira Yusri. She's the co-founder of Undi 18, Hannah Jambunathan, who's a women's rights activist, as well as Kula Ratnam Vijay Kumar from the Yayasan Tunku Abdul Rahman. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dasharan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.